Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we offer you one of the best of Talking History, or at least one of the most popular programs of the past year. It aired the week of April 26, 2004, and included an interview Fred Nielsen did with Edmund Russell on his book, War and Nature. We take up the program with Dan Roberts, A Moment in Time.
In the late summer of AD 79, the stratovolcano Vesuvius, which towers over the Bay of Naples, erupted. There was a tragic loss of life.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
Vesuvius is a relatively young volcano, a little less than 200,000 years old. It towers a little more than 4,000 feet over the waters of the Bay of Naples and the plain of Campania in south-central Italy. Approximately halfway up the sides of the volcano is a high, semicircular ridge called Mount Somma. But in the first century, Vesuvius had a single conical summit. Apparently, the mountain has long periods of quiescence in which there is little volcanic activity, followed by varying periods of eruption. During the quiet times, vineyards and orchards grow in the rich soil that covers the lower approaches. Higher up, groves of oak and chestnut trees proceed almost to the very summit. During the long sixth-century period before the giant eruption of 1631, apparently there were forests down in the thousand-foot-deep crater and three lakes from which herds of sheep and cattle grazed, unaware of the rumbling giant below. In the summer of AD 79, the mountain had lay quiet for centuries. Except for a powerful earthquake 17 years before, there was no advance warning to the citizens of the three small cities of Stabiae, Herculaneum, and Pompeii, which occupied the plain wrapped around the base of the volcano. The largest of the three was Pompeii, a prosperous commercial city built on a volcanic spur just to the east of Vesuvius. All three and their populations were buried under mountains of ash and rock on a warm afternoon in late summer. Next time, a cloud in the shape of a pine tree. At the University of Richmond, this is Dan Roberts.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, Abraham Lincoln is one of the most often quoted people in American history. But according to recent reports, quite often, he never said any such thing. The Illinois Historic Preservation Agency has added a page to its website that identifies several such attributions, including, "To sin by silence when they should protest makes cowards of men." There's no honorable way to kill, no gentle way to destroy. There's nothing good in war except its ending. And you can fool all of the people some of the time and some of the people all of the time, but you cannot fool all of the people all of the time. As explained by Rodney Davis, co-director of the Lincoln Studies Center at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois, it's simply Lincoln's own status as a cultural exemplar that makes these spurious quotations seem credible. To find other examples of famous lines never uttered by Abraham Lincoln, go to illinoishistory.gov/facsimiles.htm. This is Talking History, and yes, I really said that. Is there a link between chemical weapons and pesticides, or at least a historical connection in their development? Talking History's Fred Nielsen takes up that question with his guest this week, Edmund Russell.
During the 20th century, humans developed technologies of awesome and tempting power. Among the most dramatic were weapons capable of killing on an unprecedented scale, and chemicals that seemed to promise the extermination of insect pests. According to my guest, Edmund Russell, these developments were linked ideologically, scientifically, and organizationally. The control of nature, he writes, expanded the scale of war, and war expanded the scale on which people controlled nature. Edmund Russell is a professor of technology, culture, and communication at the University of Virginia, and the author of War and Nature, Fighting Humans and Insects with Chemicals from World War I to Silent Spring. Professor Russell, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
You write that chemical weapons framed the 20th century. How did they come to be used?
Chemical weapons had a long history. Our first recorded use took place in 428 BC when the Spartans burned pitch to try to interfere with enemy soldiers. But we reached a turning point in the 20th century when industrialized chemical warfare was introduced. World War I was the turning point for this. It was initiated by Germany, who used chlorine gas in 1915 against enemy soldiers. Now, chlorine was a chemical that was commonly used in the German dye industry, which was a very, very strong and large industry. As Germany found itself closed in and cut off from a lot of supplies, it looked to new weapons to help it win the war, and it decided to try using chlorine, which it let just drift across the lines on the wind to poison and suffocate enemy soldiers. Well, their use kicked off a defensive arm race initially, in which both sides looked for gas masks that could protect soldiers from these weapons. And it also kicked off an offensive arms race. Both sides looked for, found, developed new and more powerful chemical weapons over the course of World War I and introduced them into battle. One way to think about this is that this was a process of substituting technology for labor. As part of the larger development of industry over the past couple hundred years, we've seen this in many industries, and warfare was not exempt.
There's a kind of paradox here, it strikes me. Some people early on and even later advocated the use of chemical weapons by arguing that they were more humane than other weapons. And yet the majority, certainly now, seems to have found these weapons especially horrific. How should we understand that dichotomy?
That dichotomy breaks down largely along the lines of the advocates, who were primarily chemists and members of the Chemical Warfare Service of the U.S. Army on the one hand, and the opponents, who were almost everyone else on the other hand. The opponents included professional soldiers. The advocates, the chemists who helped set up the chemical warfare program in the Army, and the members of that part of the Army, thought that gas was more humane because it killed a lower percentage of its victims than did traditional weapons such as bullets and bombs. A number of statistics were collected, and they vary, so none of them are completely reliable, but I'll give one estimate that hints at the usual ratio. That is that, according to this set of statistics, 7% of gas victims died versus 28% of victims of bullets and bombs. So a soldier could be taken out of battle, become a casualty, without inflicting permanent damage in the eyes of these advocates. Also, gas victims sometimes had trouble with their lungs afterwards, but they came home with all of their limbs, unlike victims of bullets and bombs as well, who often would lose an arm or a leg. So the advocates thought that because you could accomplish the same military goal without the same cost in human life, it was more humane. They also, in the cases when soldiers were killed by chemical weapons, didn't see how killing a soldier with a gas was fundamentally different from killing a soldier with a bullet. Either way, the soldier was dead, and they thought it was futile to try to compare the horribleness of those two methods of doing so. Now, the fact was, of course, that this view didn't triumph with other people, and so the advocates of chemical warfare did have a challenge in explaining why the rest of the public opposed these weapons. They ended up concluding that it was due to propaganda. When Germany started gas warfare, the Allies launched large propaganda efforts to portray this as a new, evil, and particularly German style of warfare. And they believed that that image stuck even after the Allies started using gas as well. Now, on the other side, you had the opponents, who had several reasons for viewing gas as especially horrific. One was that it caused a death through suffocation, which many people feel is an especially painful way to die. Some of the gases would cause the buildup of fluids in the lungs, so a person essentially drowned in their own bodily fluids. A second reason for opposition came from professional soldiers who had developed an unwritten code of civilized warfare over the previous centuries. part of that code was that armies should spare women and children as much as possible. One of the problems with gases was that once you released them, you couldn't control them. If the wind shifted direction, the gas could blow back onto your own soldiers or farther back into towns. And it did happen in World War I that gases traveled a fair distance to hit towns and cause casualties among women and children. And professional soldiers found that unacceptable.
But the battlefields of World War I seem a long, long way from fighting insects, and yet one of the central points of your book is that the production of chemical weapons is tied to the production and use of pesticides. How did that occur? What's the linkage there?
Well, these connections go both ways. In some cases, insecticides were used as poison gases. One example is hydrogen cyanide, which was used in orchards to fumigate insects that attacked fruit pests. In World War I, hydrogen cyanide became a gas used on the battlefield. The influence was also the other direction. A chemical that was known but did not have any significant use before World War I was chloropicrin. Once chemists tested it to see if it would be an effective poison gas and found that it was and ramped up production, then they started looking for other uses for it. And in the end, they found that it was an effective fumigant. And after World War I, it became a popular fumigant for use in grain silos and places like that. Now, as time went on, these links became closer in other ways, too. For example, two of the most significant classes of chemicals to come out in the late 1930s and 1940s were first the organophosphate insecticides, such as malathion and parathion, and secondly, the organophosphate nerve gases, such as sarin and tabun. Those were developed at the same time in the same laboratory by the same chemist, Gerhard Schroeder, who worked for the giant German chemical combine IG Farben. So he was developing both of those simultaneously. After World War II, the production was linked in other ways as well. In the U.S., the Army decommissioned many of the factories that manufactured chemical weapons and made them available at low cost to companies that made insecticides. One example is that Rocky Mountain Arsenal, right next to Denver, the machinery there was converted to make insecticides called Aldrin and Dieldrin. And the company that started that was soon bought out by Shell Petroleum, and that became the core of Shell's agricultural chemicals division.
There's a link at another level, too, a metaphorical level, both in terms of language and cartoons. Your book has an abundance of them. America's enemies were often compared to bugs, which during time of war dehumanized them and presumably made them easier to kill. Also, both after 1918 and 1945, there were those who claimed that insects threatened human survival, leading to calls for all-out world war against insects to match the wars just completed. Some of this seems so over the top, so bizarre, and yet so alarming, equating bugs and humans. What should we make of it?
Well, it is striking. As a matter of fact, finding advertisements in chemical industry journals that merged images of human and insect enemies with heads of national enemies such as Hitler on insect bodies helped get me started on this project, looking at the links between chemical warfare and pest control. I think several things are going on here, and at the center of most of them is the perceived triviality of insects. On the one hand, you have entomologists who, over the course of the 20th century, always felt that their profession was underappreciated and the insect threat was underestimated. So they used military metaphors quite consciously, it turns out, to try to elevate the public's perception of the insect threat and thus elevate the public's appreciation for entomologists and their services as pest controllers. In addition to emphasizing the threat, this strategy tapped into patriotism and associated the profession with top national priorities. In the case of chemical companies, it was also a way to catch readers' attention in advertisements and in some cases to try to be humorous about products that many people found rather distasteful to think about. Something that creates dead bugs is not something many people often would be so excited about spending any more time on than they needed to. So that's entomologists who spent a lot of energy describing what they did as warfare. On the other hand, you have chemical warfare advocates who described what they were doing as pest control. So they were swapping metaphors. And in this case, the perceived triviality of insects helped serve chemical warfare by reducing the moral objections to chemical warfare. By portraying human enemies as insects, the status of the enemy as human beings was reduced. As a matter of fact, I ended up developing an idea that I call naturalization. We usually refer to describing human beings in other terms as dehumanization, but I concluded that was only half the process. That half is moving humans out of the category of human. But then I think it matters what category we move humans into. It's not the same to call a human a pest as it is to call that person a pet. Those imply very different ways of interacting with them. So the ideas of extermination that developed with insects were especially useful in helping to suggest the types of treatment that enemies, human enemies, should receive.
Your book spans much of the 20th century, which you describe as the most ironic of centuries. What did you mean by that?
Well, what struck me was that life got better and worse in significant ways over the course of the century. One rough index of the way it improved is the human population, which tripled over the course of the 20th century, primarily because the death rate declined rather than because the birth rate increased. And I see that as a marvelous and wonderful development in human history. At the same time, though, we also saw an increase in annihilation of human beings in warfare. World War II, for example, killed half the people who were killed by all wars between the year zero and the year 2000. And it wasn't just the absolute numbers of people who died, but also the rate. By one estimate, people in the 20th century were 14 times more likely to die in warfare than people in the 16th century.
At the beginning of the 21st century, we're still worried about war, still worried especially about chemical weapons, still trying to figure out what our proper relationship with nature ought to be. How has your scholarly work shaped your thinking about present-day concerns?
Recent events have reminded all of us of the importance of unconventional weapons of mass destruction, such as chemical weapons. My research reinforced the notion that we need to think about these in broad terms. Most of Iraq's production of chemical weapons, for example, apparently takes place in factories built as insecticide factories or other product factories. So keeping track of all of those is important. But I don't think we should regard all of this in an entirely pessimistic way. One of the comments that often is made about weaponry is that once a weapon's introduced into warfare, you can't put the genie back into the bottle. My research suggests that's false because gas warfare dominated World War I, but wasn't used in World War II, with the exception of the Japanese in China, and of course the horrific use of gas in the Holocaust. But on battlefields, it was not used, which indicates that we can control weapons. Now, on interacting with nature, what strikes me is that things are getting both better and worse at the same time. I think often when we hear about the state of the environment, it's a story of steady decline. But my research shows that things get better, too. And it's important to recognize that and feel positive about our ability to affect change that's good for us and the species around us. And then finally, my last point is what struck me was the role that democracy played in all of these events and its ability to put into effect changes in military and civilian spheres that non-democratic governments have a much harder time doing.
Professor Russell, thank you for visiting with us today.
It's been my pleasure.
I've been speaking with Edmund Russell, the author of War and Nature, Fighting Humans and Insects with Chemicals, from World War I to Silent Spring.
In his rallying support for the American military presence in Iraq, President George Bush has called for sacrifices similar, he believes, to those facing American soldiers in World War II. But does the comparison hold? Is there a danger in linking the two? That's the subject of this week's commentary by Talking History regular Ira Chernus. Chernus is a professor of religious studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder.
With Election Day less than a year away, President George W. Bush must justify something most Americans hate, a seemingly endless string of American casualties on foreign soil. No doubt the president will argue that we must risk American lives in Iraq to bring our democratic way of life to a once-enslaved nation. He will proclaim that we are doing once again what the so-called greatest generation did during World War II. But the popular memory of the World War II era does not match the reality of that time. During World War II, poet Randall Jarrell estimated that 99 of 100 people in the Army hadn't the faintest idea what the war was about. Playwright Arthur Miller remarked on the near absence of any comprehension of what Nazism meant. If President Bush's strategists look to World War II for a political lesson, they won't find Americans who gave their lives so that foreigners could be free. Instead, they'll find Americans who were willing to sacrifice only when they felt personally endangered. The New York Times reported that the typical World War II soldier simply thought that the war must be finished quickly so that he can return to take up his life where he left it. Interviewing GIs at the front, reporter John Hersey found that they usually talked about creature comforts, secure routines, even affluence. Most historians now agree that during the war, civilians as well as soldiers wanted to win as quickly as possible in order to return to ordinary life in the safety of secure, prosperous homes. The evidence of history is that Americans have little desire to bring freedom to foreign nations if the risks to them and their military forces are more than minimal. The challenge to Mr. Bush is to convince Americans that fighting forces must risk death in Iraq to preserve our security here at home. As long as our young men and women are being killed and maimed in Iraq, appeals to the mythic image of the greatest generation may stir the voters, but not nearly enough to give Mr. Bush the margin of victory. The Bush campaign can count on public support for Iraq policies only if the public is convinced that America itself was directly threatened by Saddam Hussein. Credible evidence that Saddam's regime had weapons of mass destruction or links to Al-Qaeda would help immensely. It would suggest that our own security might be endangered if U.S. troops were to leave Iraq. It would lend substance to the administration's claim that further sacrifice is worthwhile. But the likelihood that such evidence will appear is fading fast. Mr. Bush's hopes of running as a popular war president are fading just as fast. In this respect, as in so many others, the president is falling victim to overconfidence. With no game plan beyond chasing Saddam from power, the taste of victory may turn bitter. Defeat in the November election would be the crowning irony of his war and his presidency.
You've been listening to Ira Chernus, professor of religious studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Chernus's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And finally, we'd like to introduce another special series on Talking History, the reading of parts of a never-published private diary kept by a Civil War soldier and handed down through the generations of a single Massachusetts family. It was written by J.C. Wilmarth and titled, 7 Months Suffering in Rebel Prisons. The diary begins in May 1864 with fighting around Petersburg, Virginia. It's been raining for 3 days, and the troops are wet, cold, and hungry. May 16th. Our forces commenced to retreat, slowly fading back. I was sent by the surgeon to the front to inform the senior musician that the hospital was moving back. Went to the reg and carried my message before returning to the rear, the hospital this day being my station with the wounded. Was taken prisoner by some Virginia cavalry. 142 of us were gobbled up, mostly wounded ones, and were taken to Petersburg. The well ones were put in the stone jail. The wounded were put in the rebel hospital. Our jail was a horrid place, dark and full of filth and crowded to overflowing. We arrived at this place about dark. We were marched through the principal streets, hooted at and called hard names by the fair woman. I cannot call them ladies. Men and children of that city. May 17th. Awoke this morning at daybreak. A strange sensation came over me when I tried to see the surrounding country by peering through the iron-grated windows. But still, the boys are used to the hardships of war and try to keep up good spirits in the way of jokes, songs, and storytelling. I hear one young soldier boy say to his comrade, "Thunder, Jim, we're in a jug now for the first time." Says Jim, "Well, if I am, I did not steal anything." "Well," says Soldier Boy, "you can't make them believe in Massachusetts that you're put in a stone jail without committing any crime." Which so worried poor Jimmy that he found himself sober and then mad and only found consolation by using rather abusive language to the rebel guard, in which he called him everything but a patriotic and good man. Received our first rebel rations today. It consisted of 2 hard crackers and 2 ounces of raw bacon. The crackers were very good, but the bacon was none of the best, being somewhat wormy, but hungry stomachs did not revolt, and we ate our daily bread with a good relish, laid down on the floor, and said good night. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu, or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. For more information, visit amomentintime.com. And finally, the Organization of American Historians and Talking History would like to recognize and thank the Gilder Lehrman Institute for its generous support. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.
Put him down, down to the ground.